Crime and Crime Again is a true crime podcast containing subject matter that may be graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. This episode discusses topics that may be triggering, such as sexual assault and child sexual abuse material. Please take care while listening. Rising while the rest of the city sleeps and long before the sun emerges over the horizon. Arriving to a bustling newsroom full of cameras, bright lights, and green screens. Reading and rereading scripts, clipping on a lavalier mic, hearing the producers count down to your cue. Delivering the day's news as the world around you comes to life. These were the days that Julia Nicewinder dreamed of, and she was just 1 year away from graduating college when it was her name being sorrowfully reported on local news channels on a bitter December morning. Julia Nicewinder and her twin sister Jennifer were born on January 25, 1989 in Monroe, Michigan. A city of about 20,000 people that sits in the southeastern corner of the state, right on the western banks of Lake Erie. Julia's mother, Kim, had the twins when she was quite young, and according to Julia's grandfather, Jim, he and his first wife were the twins' legal guardians until they were 11 years old. Around that time, Kim met James Turnquist, and they eventually married. When Julia and Jennifer were 13 years old, they were thrilled to welcome their baby sister, Madison. As twins often are, Julia and Jennifer were attached at the hip growing up. Julia was spontaneous and bubbly, and she had a way of making people feel seen and loved in her presence. She loved making people laugh, and she was outspoken, never afraid to share her opinions on anything. Julia graduated from Monroe High School in 2008, and then went on to attend Monroe Community College, where she graduated in 2011. Julia found that she had an interest in journalism that developed into a passion for the art. She was accepted to Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where she double majored in communications and electronic media and film. Her ultimate dream was to work for a notable broadcasting company as a news anchor and journalist. By the fall of 2012, Julia was a junior at EMU, just within reach of her career goals. In November 2012, she went on a school trip to New York City, where she enjoyed upscale Italian restaurants, visited the Statue of Liberty, and watched a Rockettes performance. But the highlight of that trip that truly set her dreams in stone was the opportunity to tour the NBC studios and meet none other than Anderson Cooper. When she returned home, she could barely contain her excitement and shared the details of her awe-inspiring experience with anyone who would listen. The frigid chill of December brought with it Julia's favorite time of year. She would always be the first to volunteer for any Christmas-themed activity, decorating the tree, blaring Christmas music, shopping, wrapping gifts, and she shared this enthusiasm for the holidays with her family. It was tradition for Julia, her sisters, and her mother and stepfather to spend a day adorning the tree with lights and glistening bulbs. Christmas festivities in 2012 were particularly exciting for Julia, as the family bought their first real Christmas tree that year. I wanted to note here that some of the information about Julia's activities on the days leading up to her death was obtained from interviews that her grandfather Jim has done. One of those interviews was with the Explore With Us YouTube channel, and another was an interview with the J is for Justice podcast. I will link both of those videos in the show notes. On December 6th, 2012, Julia made the 45-minute drive from her apartment in Ypsilanti, Michigan, to her hometown of Monroe to spend a couple of days with her family. That evening, she babysat her uncle's children while he and his wife were out for the evening, and she ended up staying the night at their house. On Friday, December 7th, Julia went to her mother Kim and stepfather James' house to help them decorate the Christmas tree with her sisters. She spent a few hours there and even posted a picture of the tree on her Instagram, along with a photo of her family's golden retriever. At some point that day, Julia went to her grandmother's house nearby. This was her grandmother Rose, the first wife of her grandfather Jim, who helped him raise her and her sister Jennifer until they were 11 years old. While at her grandmother Rose's house, Julia helped her decorate her Christmas tree, and at some point, Julia's mother Kim stopped by. According to an interview with grandfather Jim, Rose later told him that when Kim stopped by that day, she, oddly, didn't help with any Christmas decorating and was rather quiet during her visit. Eventually, she left to go back home, and when her mother was no longer present, Julia told Rose something along the lines of, quote, "I'm never going back to that house," end quote. This seemed to indicate that something had happened while Julia spent the earlier part of the day at her mother's house, possibly an argument of some sort. But Julia never elaborated on what exactly she meant by her ominous assertion. Julia stayed the night at her grandmother's house that night, which was actually not unusual. Her mother's house was only a two-bedroom, so when Julia and Jennifer were both in town, it became a bit crowded, so Julia often opted to sleep over at her grandmother's house instead. The next day, December 8th, Julia went to work at Walmart, and after work, she went on a date. On Sunday, December 9th, Julia went to work, and during her lunch break, her sisters Jennifer and Madison met her at Walmart, where they walked around the store as Julia hinted to them some of the things she wanted for Christmas. After her lunch break, they said their goodbyes and Julia went back to work. She got off work around 5 p.m. that night and went home to her apartment that she shared with two roommates. One of Julia's roommates was on a vacation to Ohio. The other roommate returned to the apartment that evening to gather a few belongings, as she planned to spend the night at her boyfriend's place. The layout of the apartment was rather unique. It was a three-bedroom, but two of the bedrooms were more like suites, with full private bathrooms. The front door to the apartment, of course, had its own lock and key, and each of the bedrooms had unique locks and keys as well, meaning that each of the roommates had a key to the front door and also had their own personal keys for their respective bedrooms. Julia's bedroom was one of the suites, with its own private bathroom. When one of the roommates returned briefly to the apartment that night, she remembered hearing the TV blaring from Julia's room, but didn't think anything of it. She left the apartment between 10 and 11 that night, and did not see or speak to Julia while she was there. Again, this particular information comes from interviews that Julia's grandfather has done on various podcasts. On the morning of Monday, December 10th, Julia's other roommate arrived home from her trip to Ohio. At some point that morning, she heard Julia's alarms going off in her bedroom, but didn't think much of it at first. But the alarms just kept going. It wasn't really unusual for Julia to ignore her alarms or hit the snooze button a few times. But after a while, the roommate tried banging loudly on Julia's door to get her to wake up, to no avail. Assuming Julia would hear her alarms eventually, the roommate left and went about her day. The other roommate still had not returned home at that point. Twin sister Jennifer didn't hear from Julia at all on December 11th, but she chalked it up to Julia simply being busy with classes and work all day. What her family would soon find out, however, was that responsible, punctual Julia didn't show up to any of her classes that day, nor did she show up for her shift at Walmart. On Tuesday, December 11th, Julia was scheduled for a shift at Walmart, and she was also set to attend the company Christmas party that evening. She had actually arranged to pick up a couple of her coworkers and carpool to the Christmas party. But Julia once again did not show up for her shift, nor did she arrive to pick up her coworkers, and her absence from the Christmas party did not go unnoticed. One of Julia's coworkers at Walmart was also friends with her mother, Kim. The coworker called Kim on the evening of December 11th, informing her that Julia had not only skipped work that day, but she also never arrived at the company Christmas party. Realizing that no one had heard from Julia in 2 days, panic started to set in for her family. It was so incredibly out of character for Julia to skip work and to not even call in sick. It was even more troubling that Julia had not even texted her sister Jennifer in 2 days. Even as they started venturing into their own independent lives, the twins remained close and either messaged or talked on the phone almost every day. That night, Kim contacted one of her friends in Ypsilanti and asked if they could go to Julia's apartment and check on her. In the meantime, Kim, Jennifer, and a friend got in the car and made the drive from Monroe to the Peninsular Place Apartments in Ypsilanti where Julia lived. While Kim and Jennifer were making the drive up to Julia's apartment, Kim's friend had already arrived and met up with Julia's roommate. They both tried in vain to knock on the door and get a response from Julia. With their concerns intensifying and Julia's bedroom door locked, leaving them unable to gain entry, they decided to call the police to conduct a welfare check. When police arrived and were also unable to get a response from Julia, they asked a security guard at the apartment complex to allow them into her bedroom. When the door was finally unlocked and police ventured into Julia's private bathroom, they were met with a disturbing scene. Submerged in water in her bathtub was the body of 23-year-old Julia Nicewender. At the time that police discovered Julia's body, her mother Kim and sister Jennifer were still on the road, heading to her apartment. While still in the car and on their way, Kim received a call from an EMS worker, asking if her daughter Julia had any known medical conditions. As it turned out, Julia did have a medical condition. Though it hasn't been specified exactly what her condition is called, she suffered from the same condition as Kim and Jennifer, which causes bouts of fainting. After she answered the EMS worker's question, Kim couldn't help but to ask him why he needed that information. What was going on? But the paramedic's only response was that he would call Kim back. Shortly after the phone call, Kim and Jennifer arrived at Julia's apartment at Peninsular Place. The scene was illuminated with the glow of red and blue lights, first responders filtering in and out of Julia's first floor apartment. Kim and Jennifer raced into the apartment, but an officer stopped them before they could enter Julia's bedroom. Absolutely distraught, both women demanded to see their daughter and sister, but were denied. The only explanation they received was that Julia was deceased. Julia was found face down in her bathtub, partially submerged in water. She was nude, her yoga pants and shirt cut off of her body and discarded on the floor beside the bathtub. Her hands were pulled behind her back, and her feet were pulled together, as though they were bound together, the ligature removed well after she had died. There were clear ligature marks on her wrists and ankles, but no ligature was found at the scene. Julia's cell phone was also found in the bathtub, submerged in the water underneath her body. Investigators found a pair of white latex gloves, intertwined together, left on the floor just outside of the bathroom. The gloves were stained with a dark reddish-brown substance, which was later revealed to be Julia's blood. Julia's bedroom was found to be in a state of disarray, despite there being no sign of forced entry. All of the windows in the apartment were closed and locked, and Julia's bedroom door had been locked from the outside. Julia's purse, wallet, laptop, and all of the wrapped Christmas presents she had bought were left behind in her bedroom. Investigators did not believe robbery to be the motive for her murder. The only things missing from Julia's apartment was a zebra-striped pillowcase that belonged to her, and the keys to both her apartment's front door and her bedroom, which she normally kept on a lanyard. This confirmed investigators' belief that whoever had killed Julia locked her bedroom door from the outside when they left. Toxicology later revealed that Julia had no drugs or alcohol in her system. An autopsy revealed a severe contusion to Julia's tongue, caused by her biting down on her tongue during the attack. It was also learned that seminal fluid was found on her body, but it's unclear exactly where it was found. The autopsy also revealed evidence of strangulation prior to her being placed in the bathtub. Julia's cause of death was determined to be asphyxiation associated with drowning. When DNA results from the pair of latex gloves came back, investigators learned that DNA from two different men was located on the inside of the gloves. One set of DNA was consistent with a man who had had a vasectomy, but the other DNA sample was too small to obtain a full profile. Investigators conducted more than 100 interviews and polygraph tests in the search for a suspect, but learned nothing to connect anyone directly to Julia's murder. Over the course of the investigation, it was determined that the latex gloves found outside of Julia's bathroom door were most likely placed there intentionally, rather than accidentally left behind. Investigators also came to the conclusion that Julia's bedroom was staged to make it appear as though a robbery had taken place. Both of these factors led to the belief that the perpetrator took great effort in attempting to throw police off their trail. On December 13, 2012, 2 days after Julia's body was found, her mother Kim and stepfather James went to her apartment to find a dress for Julia for her funeral. A couple of their friends accompanied them. But what was supposed to be a quick trip into Julia's closet turned into moving day. Kim and James packed up all of Julia's belongings, some of which into black trash bags, and moved it all into a storage unit. This was less than 48 hours after Julia's body was found. Despite her bedroom being an active crime scene, the apartment was never cordoned off. And why was Julia's family allowed to enter the apartment at all so early in the investigation? A candlelight vigil was held for Julia in Munson Park on December 14th, where dozens of people attended to offer condolences to her family and honor Julia's memory. Her funeral was held on December 17th, and Julia was laid to rest at Erie Union Cemetery. 2 years came and went, with no movement in the case. But in early 2015, the investigation into Julia's murder took an astonishing turn. In February 2015, Julia's stepfather, James Turnquist, voluntarily gave Ypsilanti police his laptop to aid them in the investigation. On James' laptop, investigators uncovered what they believed to be child sexual abuse images, and James was subsequently arrested on charges of possession of child pornography and held on a $100,000 bond. In an affidavit later released by investigators, it was revealed that 2 days after Julia's body was found, one of her friends informed police that Julia had once confided in her that she and James did not get along, and that when Julia was younger, James sexually abused her. For reasons unknown, the friend later recanted their statement. It was also reported in that affidavit that investigators noticed a purple bathroom rug in the crime scene photos taken when Julia's body was found. That purple rug was never collected into evidence. Kim allowed investigators to search the storage unit where she had placed all of Julia's belongings, but that purple rug was never located. On March 3, 2015, the Ypsilanti Police Department officially announced that James Turnquist, Julia's stepfather, was a person of interest in her murder. This declaration infuriated Julia's family. Despite the child sexual abuse images found on James' computer and the charges that he was facing, Kim, Jennifer, and Madison were adamant that James did not do any of the things of which he was accused, including sexually abusing Julia as a child. When DNA from the pair of latex gloves was compared to that of James Turnquist, it was determined that one of the male DNA profiles did not match James. But remember, the other male DNA sample was too weak to compare to anyone. Notably, Julia's grandmother, Rose, informed police that James Turnquist had had a vasectomy, and again, one of the DNA profiles from the latex gloves was consistent with a man who had had a vasectomy. In September 2015, James went on trial for the child pornography charges, with Kim, Jennifer, and Madison standing steadfastly behind him. The first trial ended in a mistrial because the defense was not given a key piece of evidence. At the second trial, it took a jury only 44 minutes to find James Turnquist not guilty based on, 1, the fact that the images were found in temporary internet files, which were similar to pop-up ads, and could have been downloaded by anyone, and 2, the fact that it could not be proven whether the people depicted in the images were actually under 18 or not. With no forensic or physical evidence directly tying James Turnquist to Julia's murder, Ypsilanti police found themselves at a dead end. According to Kim and Jennifer, the lead detective on the case at the time agreed with them in their belief that James was completely innocent and wanted to help them clear his name. James Turnquist has never publicly been cleared by Ypsilanti police. Years passed, and Julia's case grew colder and colder. No new leads were tracked down, and no new evidence surfaced. In 2019, Kim and James got divorced. Today, Kim, Jennifer, and Madison maintain their belief that James is completely innocent of all of the things he was accused of, Other members of Julia's family, however, remain unconvinced, and this has caused some animosity between Julia's grandparents and her mother and sisters. One thing that Julia's entire family can agree on, however, is that someone is responsible for taking her life, and someone must be held accountable. Today, more than 10 years after Julia's murder, her case remains unsolved, and Ypsilanti police have no viable suspects. Julia Nieswender was a vibrant, witty, compassionate woman who was about to embark on a journey into the career of her dreams. She loved animals, zebra-striped anything, making people laugh, and most importantly, her family. Julia had a life ahead of her, a life that she was passionate about, and it was unfairly ripped away from her. If you have any information regarding the murder of Julia Nieswender at the Peninsular Place Apartments in Ypsilanti, Michigan, on December 9th, 2012, please call Crime Stoppers anonymously at 1-800-773-2587. If you'd like to request a case to be covered on the show, you'll find a link to a case request form in the show notes. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, where you'll find full episodes, complete with photos relevant to each case. You can follow the podcast on X, formerly Twitter, at Crime Again Pod, on Instagram at Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast. Links to all social media can be found in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode of Crime and Crime Again.